Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast, a podcast designed to help, support and educate men as they go through their own fertility struggles. I'm Kieran.
And I'm Sean. And we'll do that by sharing our stories of what we went through, as well as having guests share their knowledge and experience. Right, let's get into today's episode. Hello and welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast. Today I'm delighted to say that we're joined by Tracy Sainsbury. Tracy is a specialist fertility counsellor and is dedicated to providing compassionate support and guidance to individuals and couples navigating the complexities of fertility challenges. Tracy is an advisory board member for the Fertility Alliance, and she's also a mum thanks to adoption and a former foster carer. Tracy, welcome.
Thanks. Great to see you both.
Lovely to see you.
A real pleasure to have you. So I suppose if we could, like, a good place to start would be if you could give a bit of a broad outline as to what it is you do.
I work with couples, individuals at every stage and every different circumstance around fertility. For some people, they'll be thinking about freezing eggs. I work with people who are thinking of donating egg, sperm or embryos. The biggest part of my work is providing support for people at every different stage of their fertility journey. The HFEA with licensed fertility clinics say that every clinic has to have counselling available for everybody, not just if you're considering donor conception and or surrogacy and needing implications counselling, but if you just need that bit of extra support, treatment's exhausting, you know, so a bit like scaffolding. If anyone has a wobble, got your back.
From talking from personal experience, Tracy, like counselling was, I've said it before on this podcast, it saved my life, like literally. I found it a very challenging thing, my fertility journey. The acceptance of this new identity that I perceived I had, finding out that I was infertile. And I could imagine you've experienced a lot of things the other side of that that discussion. And I'm just wondering how many men do you get coming through your doors, or is it mainly women? And have you seen an increase in men?
Oh, definitely an increase in men. Within clinics, I used to be privileged to work in a clinic with one of the few male fertility counsellors. There's more women in counselling routinely, but there's even more higher percentage of female fertility counsellors. But I've been lucky enough to work with one of the best male counsellors. He's pretty awesome. But quite often, even then, male counsellors wouldn't want to see a male patients wouldn't want to see a male counsellor. They'd ask for a female counsellor. Bit random. You kind of think that men would want to speak to men, but it just reinforces we're all different. So there are thankfully a growing number of male fertility counsellors and an increasing number of men who will come into counselling, often an initial appointment as a couple, but will then, once they realise you're real, and it's not just a thing on the bottom of every letter, counselling is available. There's almost a sense of having that safe space to chat, that space just to validate that it's not just a desire for a child, but the helplessness that there isn't anything you can say or do to make it better.
Yeah. Mm. I distinctly remember that feeling of a safe space when I actually opened up. And the relief, like, off my shoulders. Like I can't, you know, it's a saying, isn't it? Like you can feel the stress fall off your shoulders, but I really did. Like I left one of those sessions particularly feeling like I'd really achieved something. Yeah. Why do you, obviously we don't know the totally ins and outs of this, but why do you think men are reluctant to speak to other men about it as a counsellor?
If men are in a heterosexual relationship that works, quite often the person they feel most comfortable speaking to is their partner. Mm. And that might be the most open relationship that they've had. Certainly more open than with parents, often more open than with friends. So knowing you can sit with a woman and talk and that your partner supports you going to see a counsellor, it can feel sometimes safer without judgment of same sex. I know when I was doing my counselling training, I specifically picked a male counsellor. So again, I think sometimes in some situations you want the same. Sometimes you want something a bit different. So not because there's a right or a wrong. I think it just, you want a safe space. And I always say, if you don't feel you gel with your fertility counsellor, change.
Yeah.
You know, it is, find somebody who is appropriately qualified. You know, fertility counselling is really specialist. It's trauma work, grief, loss, relationships, even if you're a single person. I work with a growing number of single men, you know, who are on a pathway to parenthood. So lots of men will come in. I work with the NHS sperm bank as well. So I work with very fertile men who are hoping to help others. So really broad range of men who will come into fertility counselling before, during and after treatment.
Yeah, that's really encouraging to hear that men are coming forward and talking. And there was a couple of really salient points there, is that we are, as a gender, not so good at talking to our mates, which is something that certainly Kieran and I advocate for. And we speak passionately about how much that helped us once we did start doing that. And we often say, give your friends the opportunity, like put your trust in them and allow them to repay that faith as to why they are your friends. Because actually I found that I held back a long time from doing that. And when I did, all my doubts disappeared, because they were, the way they handled that information was so respectful and just so empathetic. And I gave them that chance and it was rewarded. And also, I think it's a great point that it's just by holding that space and allowing people to let the steam off and air their thoughts and their fears and their anxieties, and knowing that there's nothing that you can say on the other end to make it better. And that's, it's so important, because people will often try and fill that space with some kind of positivity or platitudes that they don't need. We all know the kind of the famous ones in the fertility space, such as just relax, just go on holiday, you know, that nonsense, which you don't need to hear, is just holding that space is so important.
Yeah. I also work with, in my private practice, with a lot of couples who haven't yet got into the clinic, where there's penile erectile dysfunction or vaginismus that makes intercourse impossible or really, really difficult. So with a lot of men, where they're doing home insemination, and it's that thinking outside the box and knowing that you can access support before you go into the clinic. You know, it's really having awareness of just how many resources and support opportunities are there. When I say every step of the way, it is from when you first think about family planning.
That's really interesting to me, because I'd never thought about it like that before.
Yeah.
Have you seen that? Has that increased lately, with maybe the awareness around fertility on the increase?
Yeah, because people are talking about it. I think it's advertising. So there are more general adverts that suggest that people are having problems having intercourse. It puts a lot of pressure on, you know, the NHS guidance is routinely now 2 years, intercourse 3 times a week, every week. You know, before you can access NHS treatment, quite often the social criteria that's put there. So for anyone who is struggling with intimacy, then there can often be a real push to access support. So I train psychosexual counsellors around fertility, and quite often psychosexual counsellors will work on the sexual side and then refer to fertility counsellors to access support around conception.
That's it's really interesting, and certainly we've definitely spoken before about that kind of pressure when you are trying to conceive, and it just changes the aspect of that intimacy between your partner, you and your partner, and it's hard.
Yeah,
it really is. I'm interested to know kind of what are some of the common themes that come up when men come to you around, like fertility issues and struggling to conceive, or infertility as well?
I'm going to be really basic, because I like basic. And there's a real difference between men and women. And I always think of relationships in terms of cake, because I like cake and I like things to be easy to think about. So if when a couple meet and somebody gives them cake and says, you two are great together, you've found each other, got relationship cake, it's fabulous. When you're ready to make babies, that cake gets even better. It's got icing on, jam and cream in, best cake in the world. And a man's primal unconscious drive and desire for family goes, great, we've got a family cake. We've not just got cake, we've got cake with icing, cream and jam, it's great. There can often be a real sense of, we'll get through this, we'll be okay, we're great together. There's almost a solid awareness that there's potential here, we'll be okay, whatever happens, a real strong belief. A woman's primary drive and desire, it's like primal earth, mother earth, you put here to make babies, can feel like she's failing and letting down the cake by not delivering the cherry on the top. So there can be, by the time people come into counselling, there can be a real recognition of the difference that women often, and I'm going to be sweepingly basic here and it can sound judgmental and it's not, but I think a lot of women want their male partners to talk and can be surprised by how different the emotions and how they're expressing it can be. Whereas a woman can feel persecuted, punished. It can feel like people just get pregnant to piss you off and spoil your day. They weren't even trying, they're just there. Whereas often it doesn't feel quite as punishing in the same way for male partners. It absolutely can do at times, but often there can be different layers of resilience and robustness to cope because the focus is on, we've got this, we're going to be okay. So it is an acknowledging the difference and working with ways to cope, ways to manage, ways to support, just how to navigate.
I can definitely relate to that. Like, I remember my wife, Jen, being quite emotional, openly emotional all the way through it, where I would have little peaks when I struggled. There'd be certain times, and it, for example, like when we had a failed cycle, it would be maybe a week after I would have the emotional dip because I'd been holding myself together for her. Part of that, now looking back, I think is my inbuilt stereotypical thing of what a man should be. I can't fall apart. My wife needs me, which I now know is wrong. You know, it's, yes, there's a time you've got to stand on your feet and be strong for each other, but it's all right to let those emotions out. If there are like any guys listening out there and women as well, like what strategies can they put in place in a situation that is so out of control, like fertility? How can they put something in place to help them feel like they have that little bit of control?
Focus on the intimacy. It's not intercourse. I'm not putting more pressure on this. It's taking pressure off, but it is real primal basic skin on skin contact is healing, reparative, acceptance of yourself and each other in your skin. I routinely say to my male clients, you know, think of yourself as a superhero. Because so often you're trying to think what to do, what am I meant to be doing? And I really want to recognize the strength of just being there. If you can be there and say, this is really shit, do you need a hug? You haven't got to put a face on. No one's got to paper over anything. No one's got to hide anything or hold anything in. If your partner's down or you're down, and it's, come on, don't worry, it's going to be fine. You can want to get the gaffer tape out and gag them. It's like, piss off. If you're getting carried away and feeling positive, you can panic. This is never going to work. We're going to be devastated if it doesn't work. I don't want to be positive. But it's like someone sucked all the positivity out of the world. So it really is be mindful, but not to be perky positive and optimistic. Be mindful to how you're feeling. Where am I feeling it? What do I need to do to respond with compassion? You know, remember, you've all got an inner 4-year-old, 8-year-old, stroppy teenage self that's a bit pissed off or a bit sad or a bit in need of a cuddle, you know, or we went through fertility treatment. My husband needed chocolate, Tunnocks tea cakes was his thing. It was a Tunnocks tea cake. It was like every hospital appointment, we got Tunnocks tea cakes in the car. You know, you need something that's a treat. So again, it is that. Think about what's going on inside. Come out of your head, go into your body, think about what you need.
Great. No, well, we were literally saying exactly the same thing, and that is really good advice.
Yeah.
Certainly something that Kira and I have shared that we both experienced was a real knock to our identity as men, our egos as well, because you mentioned, you know, that when with the cake analogy, that women are that kind of primal thing of wanting to have babies and feeling that that's their role. But certainly I was knocked when I had the diagnosis of no sperm.
Yeah.
I was like, well, what does that make me as a man? So what do you say to men, and how do you help them get through that that element of that real knock to the identity?
We went through that too. You know, we used donor sperm in our treatment, and our counsellor, Julie Tucker, we still have a Julie Tucker moment. My God, she was awesome. We'd had the chat. We'll just have a baby. We won't tell anybody. That's the right way to go. We sat in our counselling session, and the counsellor said, typical counsellor face. This was before I was a counsellor. I said, who's that protecting? And you kind of realise that I wanted to protect my husband's ego. I wanted the world to recognise him as the dad that I knew he would be. He was much more comfortable with donor sperm than I was. He said, look, I love a cat. I don't care, as long as we have kids, bring them on, we're ready. He was much more comfortable than I was. And during the adoption process, he was much more open. And it is that, recognise that there are the challenges. It's like that beautiful Japanese pottery, kintsugi. If it's broken, then repair it with gold because it's even more precious, valuable and shiny. You claim the shiny bits. Yeah, of course you're going to be broken. You can feel sense of failure. If we didn't have a sense of failing, if we couldn't reproduce, we wouldn't need IVF. We'd all just crack on and have cake. You know, it's not in your head. It's every cell in your body is ready to move on to the next stage that everybody else is doing so easily. It can just feel a bit unfair, cruel, unkind, punishing. We live in such a pronatal society, women especially, but men too, will make judgments around people whether or not they've got a child. You know, how many kids have you got? Why not? You know, are you having another one? If you've got one, it's like, whew, give me a chance. You know, so and again, it is that allow yourself the time to heal, but don't ignore and certainly don't paper over. Repair with gold and be proud. Recognize the strength.
Yeah, I think that's really important advice. Not just, you can't paper over it.
If you think you've got to heal, you consistently fail through life because this stuff's going to come up again and again and again and again. I work with a client. One of the clinics I work with have open door counselling. So we work with people who had treatment 30 years ago. It's blooming amazing. But, you know, if friends are becoming grandparents and it's brought up your fertility journey, friends often don't want to know. They don't want to talk about it. But fertility counsellors are still there for you decades after your fertility journey because this stuff stays with you. So don't feel you have to heal to get to the next point. If you're 51% ready to shift, that's often as good as it gets because 49% will be disbelieving.
Yeah. Yeah, you are right. And I refer to mine as my pilot light. It's always there. It's burning away in my mind. Sometimes it will flare up. And I had a very important lesson about that early on into just after our kids have been born. So I'd had all those triggering moments that the friends just getting pregnant around us all the time. And then just as it happens, kind of with life, the way it works out sometimes, from the moment we got pregnant with our twins, right through to when they were born, right through to when they were 3 months old, in that time, there weren't any other pregnancy announcements within my friendship group. But so when our kids were 3 months old, I just assumed, that's it, I'm healed. I've got my kids now. It's all good. And there was a pregnancy announcement. And it really took me back to those dark days when we were so desperately trying to conceive. Those feelings stirred up again. And I was like, oh, you're back. You're still here. What? No, I'm done with that. And that was a really big learning curve for me to know actually that this will always be part of me. And it was important to acknowledge that it's about making space for it, knowing what I need to do when it comes up and how what I want. And I sound like a man from that would get on very well with your husband. What I want is chocolate in those situations. And just to look after myself and be kind, because actually that was a real stark lesson that this is so traumatic that it will always be a part of me. And it's about how I carry it, how I wear it. You are right. Thank you.
I think it's a really important thing to say, because there will be people out there that expect that, you know, if they do have a positive outcome, that it all goes away. And it didn't for me either. Like, I had quite a long journey afterwards, still coming to terms with what I would come to learn about myself. And even when we were recording last series, like, we talked about some really deep things. And afterwards, I'd text Sean and I'd be like, that churned up some emotions, mate, you know? It's things that I didn't think were there. I knew they were there, but I just didn't expect them to pop up, you know?
Yeah.
So it's important, guys and girls that are listening to this, like, those emotions will stick with you. You have to learn to process them. And we said it before, it all comes down to acceptance, accepting the situation that you're in. But that's incredibly hard to do, as we can all kind of agree on, I believe.
Yeah.
You mentioned, Tracy, that when you went for the counselling, when you were going through your treatment, there was an important question raised, and that was about, and it was on the topic of disclosing about donor conception.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Jenna and I had very similar. We went into the counselling kind of undecided. We were like, okay, we didn't know what route we'd go down, and thought we might have a bit of time to play with. And actually, we came out of it 100% firmly in the opinion that we would be telling any future children and telling early and often. So what is the kind of current advice around that?
It can, again, feel punishing, because it's like, you can go out, meet somebody, have sex, get pregnant, never see each other again, and a baby's born, no one's asked any questions. If you go into a clinic and you're embracing donor conception, you're wheeled into the counsellor. It's like, you have to have counselling. It's like, oh, why do I need to have counselling? If they called it myth-busting, future-proofing and promoting a robust foundation of support as you move forward, it might be a bit of an easier sell. But that's exactly what we want to do in counselling: myth bust, future proof, and promote a robust foundation of support. Because we don't just think about you, we think about a child born through donor conception. So being comfortable, you two are blessed to be in relationships with your partners where there's an openness, a transparency, you can talk to each other, you communicate well. And I bet if you've been out during the day and you've got back together in the evening, your partners can tell if you've had a good day or a bad day before you've said very much. And your kids can do the same. So with children, we very much promote being comfy. So we talk about the narrative. And I always say to my parents, my clients, talk about it from when your child's about 6 months old. I always say to create a photo album. You know, the old-fashioned ones with the peel-back plastic. If it's a couple, picture when you met, recognizing what an abundance of love there was and how much you wanted to be together. Picture when you reached a point where there was the family love cup was overflowing and you were ready to have children. We tried and tried to have a baby and it didn't work, and we went to see the doctors, and the doctors and nurses just weren't clever enough, and they said that we think the best chance of a healthy baby is to embrace donor conception. Picture of the sperm bank or egg bank homepage, or sending off the email to confirm the match with an embryo donor, whichever way you go. But that photo reinforces that your donor hasn't chosen you. You haven't rescued and neglected or abandoned egg or sperm. You haven't signed up to adopt an egg or rescue a sperm. You know, it's not an absent biological parent organization. It is an egg bank or a sperm bank. a picture of your favourite beach, and a picture of your embryo. You're as tiny as a grain of sand on the beach when you're transferred into mummy so mummy and daddy could grow you. Pregnancy test, scan photo, pregnancy shot off into family life, age about 2. We were so pleased to find out that in the UK, the donor had helped create 3 girls born in these years, 5 boys born in those years. We hope they're as happy in their families as we are in ours. There was so much love in our family, we went back to the clinic and transferred another embryo, and do you know what, it worked again. Because when you've got the narrative, it puts enough meat on the bones for a little person to ask a bit more information as and when they're ready. Takes that pressure off.
So I believe that the previous advice, like a generation ago, was to not tell, because I guess they didn't know how far DNA testing would come and how easy it would be.
Since 1991, we promoted openness and transparency, but some clinics said, don't tell. Counsellors have always said, be open. You know, the research, especially from the counsellors who set up Beaker, the Donor Conception Network is 30. You know, it's been openness and transparency. Now, we never recommended being open and talking about it because of DNA tests. It's that non-verbal communication. Children who found out later or badly had a sense that there was something. Donor-conceived people wanted a certificate of donor conception. You know, if you're adopted, you lose your birth certificate. You gain a certificate of adoption, so adoption can't be hidden. Donor conceived people wanted a certificate of donor conception, but the Nuffield review said no. It's got to be that counsellors will advise clinics, but all staff who work in clinics should advise parents to tell a child from a young age about being donor conceived, and counsellors should explain why and suggest a way of doing it. You know, so it goes further now, but the onus is still on parents. And if a parent isn't comfy, we look at, you know, well, what are the barriers? In adoption, you have months and months of preparatory workshops, meetings with social workers to make sure that you're comfy in holding that narrative for your little person so that it's a safe place for them to think or feel whatever you want. We love you unconditionally. We do exactly the same with donor conception. Welcome any question or challenge as an opportunity to provide clarity of the facts. And the HFEA's announcement just before Christmas that in the future there's the hope that parents will be able to access the identifying information of the donors from when they give birth reinforces that there's a growing curiosity for earlier access to information.
It's really, really interesting stuff. As we spoke previously, like, this is a new world for me. We didn't go down the donor conception. So I kind of have a question of, if you've got a couple or a patient that is going down that route and they come to see you for that first counselling session, what would that look like? Because I would have no insight of what that would look like. And I expect there'd be people listening to this podcast that might be headed in that direction and have, I wouldn't say concerns, but be thinking about what that's going to look like, especially from a male point of view. I might be a bit anxious about that first interaction with a counsellor. So what would it look like?
Routinely, it's tell me about you. What's the journey been like to get to this point? And hopefully that promotes space to check the space. Do I feel safe enough? I love working online. I'm now based in West Wales. I much prefer it to being in any clinic because you can be at home. You haven't got to put front on or get anxious coming into a clinic to open up and explore things. You can speak from wherever you feel comfy and turn off if it's too much ultimately. You know, you're in control. So it's about reflecting on the journey, where they are now, what their options are, how many children they'd hope to have. We want to future-proof a bit. If somebody wants 3 children and they have a child first time, everything goes well, but there's no egg, sperm or embryos remaining, it'd mean a different donor. We'll talk about families blessed in different ways with different donors. you know, or that how it might be if there are embryos remaining after your family's complete, as a reminder that they can get back in touch for support. And that there's never a guarantee, even if I work with couples where there's a low chance of a successful outcome, it's very much, you're going to be hopeful. We recognise, we acknowledge it's going to be a roller coaster. The highs are there because there's so much love they want to have a family. The lows are there because there's so much love they want to have a family and there's no control. And it's powered by rocket fuel. You know, for women, especially with any hormonal treatment, it's speed of light sometimes from highs to lows. So we look at coping strategies for self-care, the legal framework around donor conception in the UK. We have a 10 family limit for donors. You know, it's making sure that they're comfortable with what information can be accessed at what point of time. Differences if people are considering going overseas or having treatment in the UK and how that might work. We talk about home DNA kits, but also genetic half siblings, questions that can come up in the future. The reality about donors, you know, only between 3-5% of the men who apply to donate are accepting. It takes about 15 months to be a sperm donor, much quicker for an egg donor. You know, and we have the same conversations with donors, same counselling about being open with partners, parents, their own children, brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, aunts, uncles, cousins. We wouldn't want a donor-conceived person to do a DNA test, show us a cousin connection to the donor's sibling's child and think they've abandoned loads of kids everywhere. You know, it's about that, taking the blinkers off a bit and putting a bit meat on the bones about what this means.
For that to happen, there's a lot of processing that needs to go on. Is there a set number of sessions, or would it be it takes as long as it takes to kind of work through those emotions and that understanding and that processing?
Routinely one.
Right. Okay.
And that can sound shocking, but it is routinely one, an awareness of further support being available.
Okay. Is that the same for adoption as well?
Oh, gosh,
no. In terms of, no.
No. In adoption, you'd tend not to have counselling for adoption. You might if your social worker refers you for counselling. I work with lots of people who will have fertility closure counselling. So they'll come in almost to make sure there's no loose ends before they go on to adoption, or at least triggers that they're more aware of. And then with adoption, you have your initial preparatory groups and then weekly or fortnightly sessions with your social worker, often for about 6-7 months, and with additional training in between, and then go to panel to be approved, and then they'll start looking for a match for you. Our adoption process was ridiculous. We adopted in 8 months, but that's not normal.
Yeah, I knew there was the multiple layers that you had to go through for the adoption. But I didn't know where it started in terms of where that counselling comes in. But I'm sure that there'll be listeners out there that really appreciate the information, so thank you.
There is, for anyone considering adoption, there's a little first steps in adoption modules that you can just do from home and have a look at that just puts a bit of meat on the bones and gives you a bit of an idea. I'll ping the link over so you can share that.
Yeah, thank you. You touched upon something about kind of people doing like DNA searches, ancestry.com, etc. And something that was pointed out to us by our counsellor, which I can't remember how it came onto it, but it was contextually, it was just so vital that something that people considering this route have to bear in mind, it might not be your future children looking outwards, it could people be contacting them inwardly who they might have no desire to do that, but then other people might find that somehow. And in this day and age, it is so prevalent, and you know, obviously social media is making the world a smaller place as well.
And
you have to be prepared for that, and that really stood out to us, and it all comes down to that kind of being prepared for it and having an open mind as to all of these aspects which you might not have considered before. And that's why for us the counselling was so important, so vital.
I have a huge group, a small group in compared to some, of 24 donor conceived people who found each other on ancestry.com, connected with the donor's sibling on Facebook, worked out which one of her brothers was the donor, and tracked him down on LinkedIn. And they asked me to see if I could provide him counselling. I've got permission to share, and I'm not mentioning any names, but they've blogged about it, so I'm allowed to talk about it with their consent. And they wanted counselling for the donor because only 3 of the 24 were interested in meeting or having any contact with him. The others were all much more interested in genetic half-siblings. So you don't know. Anyone thinking about donor conception, there's never a guarantee that somebody would be interested or curious or want any contact. I have males who are donor conceived whose female partners want them to find out, reach out, contact the donor to make sure there's nothing new in the genetic familial history that would be relevant to them having their own family. So there can be things that aren't even connected to the person who's donor conceived that can come up as well from within their family. So again, it's the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah. And this is why it's so important to have these conversations and give everyone the considerations that do need to be had. Yeah. And the conversations, because it's not something you do once and then it goes away. It's a lifelong consideration. And for us, what was really important was, of course, it was about us and our desire to be parents, but we then really had to shift our perspective to future children and ask the questions that they might want to ask and couldn't. And we were being their advocates from before they were even conceived, to say, how could they feel about this? What questions, what might they have, and what would we do in that situation? And that helped us get to that point of rock solid acceptance that was the right path for us.
One of the things that lots of people ask in counselling is, how do I choose a donor? You know, and when you've thought about how impactful this person might be for a child in the future or not, but does that influence our decision? How does that work? And I've been in trouble before for saying that boring men don't donate, and that I actually stand by it. I've worked in sperm banks for a long old time. Men who donate have awareness of a need for sperm. They have a level of creativity to think outside the box, to be brave enough to go into a clinic and get tested when they've got no known fertility problems, because they want to help. And then they will jump through all of the hoops. 98 out of every 100 men who apply, they make it. You know, they'll go in every week for 6 months to leave a donation, go away for 6 months, come in, repeat the screening tests, and then the sperm's available. So their generosity of spirit, ego, says my genes are good enough to share. Every parent who considers or embraces donor conception has a level of creativity to say, I'm not going to be stopped in my desire to have a family. And I've got an ego that says, two right, I'm good enough to parent. Bring on the help of a donor. You know, it's a beautiful match.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Really, it's such a great point of view. And certainly with the six kind of choices that we whittled down to, only two had done the pen picture, which isn't mandatory. Obviously, having the mandatory information that they all have to include. But out those two that did write that, firstly, we found, like, humanistically an instant connection with them, and we found ourselves being drawn towards them because it was almost like we knew them a little bit, because they were writing about themselves, their background, their family. But also in both of those cases, they were donating their sperm because they had required the use of other donation, egg donation for their partners. And it was, like you were saying, it's that, all the hoops they have to go through to do that. And because they were so appreciative of what they had been given that they wanted to give back. And we actually didn't go for those, either of those in the end, because we decided that we wanted a complete blank picture. We didn't want to know anything about them. We wanted our children to flourish into who they were. And but it was I found the psychology behind it interesting, that we were drawn to them because we knew something about them. And it was really heartwarming to read, actually.
When donors don't do their pen portraits, it's often because they're a bit stifled. They are writing a letter to someone who may or may not exist, and it can just feel a bit overwhelming. Quite a few of my donors won't do that until they have their own children, and then suddenly it's, oof, better write something, and their partner will help, and the kids might put something in, and then they'll update it. Because donors can update their information, so you can always check in and see if they've added anything.
Thank you. That's a great bit of knowledge there to know.
It's a real complex discussion, in terms of just listening to you talk, because I've got 1,000 questions in my head and they can't be answered all in a podcast. So I can't imagine how, I've said it to Sean in the past, I admire him so much to be able to process everything that he's been through and to get to where he is, to make the decision to have donor sperm, process that. And he talks about why, how he was able to process it. Do you get, in terms of the processing side of things, does it come quicker with women or does it come quicker with men? And I know that's a really kind of loaded question, but how does each sex kind of deal with it?
For being really stereotypical, women often like a plan. The lack of control can drive you a bit nuts. So there's normally plan A, plan AB, plan B, plan B, 1, 2, 3, and 4. We'll do this, that, and the other. And if this, then that, but that, maybe this, whatever. And there's lots and lots of plans, lots of options. If we don't do this, we'll do this. For a man, there's often, let's take it a day at a time. This is what the clinic have said. Listen to what they've said. This is how we feel. This is what we're going to do. And that's enough. And then the frustration can be there because you can't get the same enthusiasm for plan B because you're on plan A where she is. So I'm going to slow down a bit. Join me in plan A. We're moving forward with plan A. We haven't been told we need anything else yet. Let's just enjoy plan A for a bit and not have to think about anything else. And it, men and women work a bit differently like that. So when we think of the speed of processing, nothing is set, because I'll work with women who've thought of donor conception for a year or two as an option. And that's what we'll do. And it comes to it, I can't do it, it's too overwhelming. Whereas a man who's listened to it for a couple of years, but it's not on his radar, suddenly thinks, okay, if that's what the clinic advised, let's look into it a bit more. I'm ready now. So it's completely different. But I work with people who will plan treatment, have ordered donor sperm, have medication in the fridge, day one of their period, their feet don't take them to the phone to call to book a scan. We can't do this cycle, just not there. And that can be frustrating for male partners who say, well, go at your pace, I'm really happy to. But when they've been saying, right, we're definitely going this month, definitely going this cycle, it can be like, should I have done more? Have I said something wrong? Did I give off the wrong signal? No, she just wasn't ready. So that's where counselling can help provide that space to hold when it's really confusing for everybody.
We want to tell you about Impril, the unique supplement for conception, which is recommended by fertility specialists for both men and women. We know that good nutrition is really important for fertility, but we are also aware that it's practically impossible to maintain a diet that is perfectly balanced, especially for conception. Choosing the right supplement can be confusing. Many multivitamins contain strong antioxidants, which can actually damage sperm quality. Impril is made from activated micronutrients that help every cell within the human body, from the biggest, the egg, to the smallest, the sperm. These micronutrients have been clinically proven to significantly improve live birth rates for men and women who have previously been struggling to get pregnant. You can find out more and hear from couples who have used Impril by visiting fertilityfamily.co.uk. If you decide this is for you, as a 10% discount just for our listeners. So make a note of the code MF10. That's MF10.
Yeah, we've both talked openly about how, you know, the pressures it can have on your relationships.
Mm.
I even said at one point to my wife, you know, if you want to leave, leave. Like, this is my issue, you know. And I was really blessed with the fact that she turned around and said, no, I love you, you know, I want to be with you. So I guess that fertility counselling can almost turn into couples counselling at some points, where you're working through a whole level of complexities.
Routinely. And for single people, it's every relationship. You know, it's relationship counselling, whether you're single or in a relationship.
Yeah, it's important people hear that, though, because it's literally everyone that's going through it at some kind of interpersonal level. A relationship will be affected by it, whether it's, even if you've got the most solid relationship in the world with your partner. Like, for me, it was externally in my family. Those relationships changed because of other people's views and what people said. And that's where, like I said at the beginning, counseling helped me so much. I was able to get that out, like, and realize and accept so much that had happened in such a short amount of my life. I've come to, this is a slightly lighter topic, where I've come to realize, and you said it perfectly there, if my wife wants me to do something, she drip feeds it in, and I have that moment of, yeah, yes, do that. And you just explained it there perfectly, you know. And we've talked about it in previous podcasts, you know, guys that you put pressure on to do something or change the plan very quickly. I remember my anxieties used to go through the roof. I was like, yeah, but that's not the plan. Like, I've got one plan. And Jen had A, B, C, D, E, F, G. So, you know, giving your partner time to process that, male and female, you know, it's 'cause men can want to push forward too sometimes, you know, and giving your partner time to really process that and allow them to do that with someone that's qualified to help them navigate that is such a valuable tool.
Money's important as well. You know, especially if treatment is private, men and women have quite different relationships with money. Your unconscious can be shouting, you can't put a price on a baby. You feel bad, sad, ashamed, embarrassed for thinking about the money. That's important in the mix as well, you know. So having those difficult conversations, equally recognizing treatment's like a full-time job, you know, so it puts life on hold. There's multiple layers of grief. Ideally, you conceive through beautiful romantic lovemaking or rubbish sex with the right person rather than jumping through any extra hoops or paying anybody, you know. So there's lots of frustrations, anxieties, irritations that are just there that are appropriate. A few extra skills and strategies to manage them can always be welcomed. You know, if you're listening to this and you're in a clinic and they've got free counselling, book in. You know, it might be worth it.
So on that note, I think we've covered it before, but should every fertility clinic be offering free counselling, or is it an added kind of bonus if your clinic does?
Yeah, lots of the clinics now charge for counselling. It feels more routine that counselling is charged for. Some it's still free, or a partial refund is given off the cost. But it can be priceless. You know, I know our appointment, and I'm going back over 20 years now, but our appointment, my God, it was worth its weight in gold. As I said, we still have Julie Tucker moments now.
I just thought of something that has come up with people that have contacted me. There are some men who really cannot get their head around the thought of someone using someone else's sperm to impregnate their female partner. Do you have any kind of tips or advice in that respect of that block?
it's not always right to push it. Donor conception isn't for everybody. And life isn't kind or fair. And not everybody has the same tolerance levels or abilities to move forward. Half of the people I work with who are considering donor conception don't move forward with treatment. You know, and it's not always because of the man. It's not always because of the woman. It's often just because lots of other stuff is in the mix and it doesn't feel right. They're going to parent a different way. You know, so absolutely have the time and space to explore. But it's not about breaking someone down so they feel okay about it, give them enough time, they'll be fine, because that's not what it's about. It's about making sure you're comfy with your decisions. I live in West Wales, and there's a little beach down the road, and there's a dinky little couple. Every day, 4 o'clock, they're sat on the beach, and he's got this tray that's got legs. So it's like this dead old-fashioned table thing that they open up. He takes his Adidas bag that looks like a retro school bag. It's brilliant. Takes out all these bottles and a little Ziploc bag of ice and mixes them a cocktail. It's fab. Desperate to sit down with them and say, tell me your story. But I reckon they've lived. You know, if you sat on a beach or in the shelter or on the grassy verge bit, having a cocktail every day at 4 o'clock in your 80s, thinking back on the life you've lived and the decisions you've made, you've done stuff, haven't you? And I kind of think, if you give yourself time and space to explore where you're at and you work out what's manageable and what's not, and then you move forward, you always know you've done what you felt was right at the time. And that's the greatest gift you can give yourself, the time and space to explore, to be real, to not put a front on, to claim it, because otherwise it's just going to trip you up later on.
Yeah, that is amazing advice. And yeah, I actually always say that just because donor conception was right for me doesn't mean it's right for the next person, and I will never push it on anyone. Because we're all different. That's what makes life beautiful, is that if we're all the same, it'd be very boring.
And it doesn't always work, you know. I mean, it can be sold as a solution, but it's really a possibility. It's never guaranteed.
Yes, I think that's a really important statement to make, because there's almost another journey beyond that, and that is the treatment journey, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, which is challenging on its own, let alone with the, with donor sperm or donor eggs involved.
I'm smiling because when we went through treatment, we were on our fourth donor because they kept selling out. People think there's not much choice of sperm now. They used to offer it to more than 10 families, assuming some wouldn't get pregnant, and then say, oh, sorry, you've got to change your donor. I was working as an office manager in a firm of occupational psychologists, and all of the women in the office were on maternity leave while we were going through IVF with donor sperm. So I'd got an office full of blokes. The clinic phoned, your sperm donor's gone. So you're going to have to pick another one, but we can't guarantee, you've got egg collection next week, we can't guarantee we'll get any sperm here in time. So I'm sat in the office sobbing, I just need sperm. With an office. Thankfully they were all psychologists, but my God, it was awful. You couldn't make this stuff up. You know, it is just for God's sake. So it is better we have more men coming forward to donate now. It's just rubbish that, frustratingly, you can have fabulous amounts of sperm, Olympic swimmers, you know, all great shaped heads doing wonderful things, but it's just not hardy enough to survive the freezing and thawing process, so they're not going to be accepted as a donor. So again, it's that life can be really shit at times. You just do the best you can with what you've got, and remember to ever put as much energy in, more energy than is coming out.
Amazing. Well, I feel, you know, we try and end each episode with a question of, but I feel like you've covered it so many times over. Like, we could take a segment of anywhere from this podcast and put it here. But is there what would be the one piece of advice that you would give any man facing fertility difficulties?
Stand in the mirror, look at yourself, and know you're damn strong just for being able to stand there and claim it. But remember to do that. Don't be too hard on yourself. Acknowledge the strength of you and remember you haven't got to say anything, you haven't got to do anything. Just be available for the person you love. I'm here for you. Do you need a hug? And when you need a hug, ask for one.
That's amazing advice. I wish I'd done that a lot earlier in my own journey, because it would have helped me a lot. Really would have. And my partner and my wife. It would have helped her a lot as well. So thank you, Tracy. Really appreciate you coming on and having this really open and honest discussion with us, because there will be guys listening to this that feel lost at the moment. And I'm hoping that this conversation and the rest of them that we have on this podcast can help, you know, navigate them through whatever part they're at. So thank you so much.
No, you're very welcome.
Absolutely echo that. It's been amazing. That literally an hour full of just so many takeaway important points for and yeah, it will help so many people. And I cannot thank you enough for coming on and getting this out there.
Well, have a lovely evening, guys. Look forward to speaking to you again.
Yeah, definitely. Before you go, if people want to contact you, what's the best way for them to do that?
My website is fertilitycounselling.co.uk, and you can message me through the website or tracy.sainsbury@fertilitycounselling.co.uk.
That was absolutely amazing, and we'll speak soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favour and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at The Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.